This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. With a father, grandfather, and older brother in the ministry, it wasn't surprising that John Heinemeier chose to become a pastor. But his five decades of ministry have been filled with surprises. When he graduated from the seminary, the young man from a small town in Texas made only one request for placement: any large city on salt water. And in 1963, he and his wife were called to a large city on salt water of sorts, Brownsville, Brooklyn, one of New York City's most devastated and dangerous areas. The placement was just the first of many callings to tough inner-city ministries. Reverend John Heinemeier embraced his work in some of the nation's most difficult neighborhoods, and he believed his faith meant more than offering good words from the pulpit. He worked to develop the Nehemiah strategy for low-income housing in Brooklyn and the South Bronx. The work revitalized communities and offered affordable housing for some of New York City's neediest citizens. Pastor Heinemeier went on to serve African-American and Latino congregations in Boston and East Baltimore, addressing not only the spiritual but also social and economic needs of those communities. After a brief stint in retirement, John Heinemeier now heads an Episcopal church in Oxford, North Carolina, where he continues to integrate multicultural communities. Reverend John Heinemeier, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Well, given that history, father, grandfather, older brother, maybe it wasn't surprising that you would go into the ministry. Was it ever a question in your mind that you would be a minister?
Oh, yeah. I would certainly have to say that it was. While the line was fairly direct and simple, it wasn't really until I pretty much got through seminary that I was convinced that this is what I needed to do. And some of the pivotal experiences that led up to that certainty, I think, were, for example, in my graduate year at the seminary, I worshiped in a Lutheran church across the Mississippi in Alton, Illinois, a black congregation. And I did a kind of internship in a black congregation in St. Louis as well. So already then, it wasn't just simply taking on the mantle of ordination. It was wanting to be engaged with communities of color. I saw the congruence between scriptures and their lives and their histories. I've often said that the Old and New Testament is a book for all people, but it is primarily a book for poor people. It's their story, first of all. And in that light, it's been so very easy to be a pastor in a black or Latino community. I don't have to be talking so much against people's values. The scriptural witness is the story of their lives, and it's to be received in that context, to be accepted in the, let's say, in the black community has always been a matter of grace to me, kind of unexpected and undeserved.
That the word would be accepted in those communities?
No. I knew that the word would be accepted, that you would be accepted.
Well, but there is some pushback on that. You say this is ultimately the story of poor people. There's pushback that says, this story is for all of us, meaning all of us, and that there is no preference for rich or poor, Greek or Jew, et cetera, et cetera. And so how do you come to that understanding that this is ultimately a story about the disenfranchised?
I think it's fairly obvious in scriptural study. Jesus spent a lot of time with poor people. Those are some of his best friends, and he had more problems with the elite, especially the religious elite of his time. And I think the liberation theologians adage that there's this preferential option, I think it's something that I certainly subscribe to. And I've just been fortunate and blessed to be in-house with that.
You talked about serving in an African-American congregations, either in seminary or just after, but you also had experiences in the cotton fields of Texas perhaps before that. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I grew up in rural Texas. We only wore shoes in the wintertime. And every summer we were out in the cotton patch. I asked people in North Carolina, which is harder, tobacco or cotton? And they almost universally say cotton. And so there's where I was every summer, both chopping and picking cotton. And it so turned out that my colleagues in this painful work were African Americans. And that kind of solidarity of pain, I think, stuck with me. It wasn't a social relationship. That didn't come until much, much later. 1962, as a matter of fact, was the first time that my then fiance and I had a meal in a black home in St. Louis. First time ever that I had a social relationship with a black family.
When did you become, I'm wondering in those cotton fields, if you had, was there any privilege? Did you enjoy any privilege in those fields? And when did you first notice that you obviously had privilege?
Oh, yeah. That was unmistakable. I had privilege. I didn't earn any extra money. But no, it was clear. Yeah. The boss was always white. And I was, I suspect, given some leniency in terms of how much profit I made for him each day. It was unmistakable. Privilege was there.
So when you graduated from seminary, you said in your exit interview, send me anywhere, any large city on salt water. Why?
I was disenchanted with the Middle West. I just, even though that's where I found my wife. She's a native of Fort Wayne, Indiana. I met her when I was on internship in Peoria, Illinois. But there were too many Lutherans around there. I was suffocated in the Middle West, and I wanted any salt water. It could have been east, south, west.
You could have ended up in Utah.
Could have been
careful,
in Salt Lake City.
Careful what you wish for.
I don't think there are too many Lutheran congregations in Salt Lake City.
That would have solved your other problem.
Yeah, right. But my life was liberated moving to Brooklyn. First time I'd ever been in Brooklyn, or my wife had ever been in Brooklyn in 1963. By the way, it wasn't Brownsville that I started. It was in a place called Canarsie, which is in Brooklyn, and it's on salt water. It's on Jamaica Bay, which is tidal. But that was a good place to start, a mostly white congregation that I helped to integrate. And then to Williamsburg, which is now a very different kind of place, and then to Brownsville.
Well, let's talk about integrating that first congregation, because this would have been about what year?
63.
What was that like?
Well, it wasn't the usual thing, I'll say that. But already it was in my blood. And in the very first class of adults who became members of that church, there were African Americans, the first African Americans in that congregation. And by the time I left there, some 4 years later, the congregation was getting used to it. But it wasn't the usual thing to do.
Well, what did you have to do? I mean, again, are people applying to the church? They certainly wouldn't be denied. What does it mean to help integrate a church in a neighborhood like that? Was the neighborhood in transition? Had it already changed?
It was just beginning to be in transition. It was an overwhelmingly white congregation, a white community, rather. We did things mainly with children in integrating it. Now you go to Canarsie in Brooklyn, and it is a changed community. It is, I think, probably majority of color. But then it was an old fishing community from way back. I mean, it was a country, practically, a country community.
Mm-hmm. What was a minister expected to do? I mean, again, you know, we sort of imagine, oh, it must be difficult to integrate, especially in those early years before we had really gotten our heads around it. Not that things are all that much better these days, but it must have been difficult. What would a pastor be expected to do if the predominantly white community did not want to immigrate? What would you be expected to do to stop that? Yeah, and I'm saying you did. I'm saying, well, how? What would they expect you to do?
The congregation certainly could have made it much more difficult than they did.
Yeah.
As it happened, it wasn't entirely easy, but it's against the grain. I took some stands in Canarsie publicly, as well as in the congregation, that made it probably more important than not after 4 years to go to a black community.
All right. Well, I tell you what, we're going to look at some of those challenges and talk about the stands that you took as my conversation with Pastor John Heinemeier, the vicar of St. Cyprian's Episcopal Church in Oxford, North Carolina, continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today I'm talking with Reverend John Heinemeier, who has served in inner city churches in New York, Boston, and Baltimore. So we're talking still about Brooklyn and that first church that you served. So what were some of the challenges that you faced in trying to integrate that church?
To plant the idea, first of all, that this could be a part of God's will, to explore what this would mean in terms of changes in the mindset of the congregation, and to start slowly, not to come in like a bull in a china shop, but to demonstrate how closely this followed the teachings of Jesus. I would say that was the intention.
Do you do most of that from the pulpit? Do you have to work behind the scenes, work with committees, organizations, find sympathizers? How does it go practically?
Yeah, you did both. You did all of those things together, and then you become proactive. You just do some things even before they are kind of part of the culture of the congregation. This has been kind of the style of leadership that I've had these past 52 years, and that is create action. Be a leader in front of the people rather than behind them. That has some penalties as well, but that's the way I've tended to act, is to create momentum, get things going that people can then join up with. And in most cases, they've been willing to do that.
They did. And then, as you say, you moved on. You found yourself in a couple of other congregations. You do get to Brownsville eventually, and that's where you get involved with a project called Nehemiah, which is a housing project. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Most people want me to talk about Nehemiah. I generally say, before I can talk about Nehemiah, I have to talk about East Brooklyn congregations, because that's what made Nehemiah possible. The first 15 years of my ministry, Canarsie and then Williamsburg, I was mainly engaged in what I would call crisis ministry. And I got a little tired of that after 15 years and looked across the line in Queens. And there was a group that had been started by the Industrial Areas Foundation called Queens Citizens Organization. I was seeing what they were doing in terms of organizing Queens, a more middle-class community. And I thought, well, we need some of that here in Brooklyn. And so I called, I think it was in 1977, a meeting of clergy in Brooklyn. It said, Do you have a will to organize here in this this godforsaken place. And there was that will, an ecumenical, even interfaith will. And we discovered that service, the provision of services, is not what we needed to do. We needed to rebuild a community. We met a visionary builder named I.D. Robbins, and we said, can we repopulate this part of New York City? There were block after block of that were abandoned, that had once been tenement buildings. And out of that came the Nehemiah Housing. It was, that name was coined by a very strong pastor in Brooklyn named Johnny Ray Youngblood, who's now in Bed-Stuy, but he was in East New York at that time. And he said, let's call this Nehemiah after the leader of the Jewish community that rebuilt Jerusalem after the exile.
And we should point out that the story is he was a rather reluctant builder, right, at first. I mean, he was not wanting to come back and then finally said, I have to do this. Look at this ruin that is the Israel after the Babylonian captivity.
Yeah. Well, that's where it got its name. And it became then the signature piece of East Brooklyn congregation's work. We did a lot of other things as well, but was the best offer for single-family homes in New York City by far. And we got all the land free from New York City after being opposed every step of the way by New York City, because this was always an indictment of their own housing policies. But little by little, these homes came into being. There were some 15 applicants for every house. By now, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 of them have been built in East Brooklyn, and those neighborhoods have been transformed. With housing ownership, almost all of them for the first time, all the owners, comes a building up of the entire community, the sanitation, the schools, the safety. All of these things were byproducts, you might say, of this new pride of ownership.
Just to describe this, and actually I reported on this for NPR back in the 80s when I first read about it. I thought it was an extraordinary program. This is the 1980s. Reagan administration said the market will take care of everything. What we saw was homelessness rising to record proportions in the United States. So why doesn't the market take care of housing people? A basic need. And this economy can't do it. So, and here's this thing, and it wasn't all nonprofit. Some of the money would actually be paid to a developer. It was slow money in a lot of ways. I was amazed that there is a for-profit answer, but it's not. It certainly isn't what the Reagan administration was promoting. Total failure on their part. And you have to describe the moonscape that was this section of Brooklyn. I had never seen anything like it. You can see expressways in the distance. It was this apocalyptic vision. If I was doing a speculative fiction book, that would be my cover. And then this little enclave of brand new homes where
one aspect of that, Frank, was the absence of street signs. The very first issue that EBC, East Brooklyn Congregations, took on was for the city to restore street signs. There would be fires reported, and the fire department couldn't find the house that was burning because block after block, there were no signs on the corners. And so that was the first issue we went into, is the replacement of street signs. But that, it wasn't just that the block was vacant. The corner was vacant, too.
Well, talk about the organization effort, because you said the city was resistant for a couple of reasons. It was an indictment, plus developers paid for mayoral races, and they didn't want to see this happening. Yes. But also, unions had to be talked to. I mean, there was some break on union labor. There was break on code, the housing codes. City had to give you the land. The state was providing, I think, low-interest loans. I mean, there's a lot of people. Talk about the organization effort to get this to happen.
One of the keys to it, it was the provision of no-interest loans by denominations, Roman Catholic, Episcopal, Lutheran. and others, with the Baptist congregations putting in their own money. That always really impressed me. They didn't have a sugar daddy to go to, and so they each congregation put up some money.
Think of the money they save on beer. I mean, that's, I think, right. Where that comes from.
But that no-interest loan for 5 years at first became kind of the key. That was a revolving construction pool. It was in the multiple millions. God bless the denominations for their foresight in doing that. There are some very interesting stories that could be told about that. When New York City was in its resistance mode, we needed the land. The city wasn't willing to give us the land. We had a meeting with Anthony Glideman, the head of the Housing Commission in New York City. This was in Manhattan City Hall. Our organizers went down to the City Hall the day before our meeting, and they found out where we're going to meet. And it was in a ornate room with a horseshoe table, with about 15 leather chairs around the table, each with a mic. And in the open end of the horseshoe was a little, maybe 3x3 folding table with a couple folding chairs for the hearee.
You had the kids' table, in other words.
That's right. We were at the kids' table.
Yeah.
Well, as you can imagine this, we got down there about a half hour early and took all the leather seats. It was just such a dramatic reversal of power. Here comes Anthony Glideman with his staff, and one of them says to him audibly, "Sir, this is a setup." And indeed it was. And he sat at the folding table. And it was 2 weeks later, meeting in the back room of Ed Koch, the mayor, drinking tea from his china, that with Bishop McGavrell, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Brooklyn, giving him advance absolution, this Jewish mayor, to rob Peter to pay Paul and to give us the land. It happened.
To what extent were the churches instrumental or vital in this, and was it a hard sell? It's a radical concept. You've got this blend of nonprofit and for-profit. People are not going to own homes. They can build equity. People at that time making maybe $40,000 a year family income can now own a house,
That's right.
They're working families. It meant everything. And to that neighborhood, it meant, because they're homeowners, a lot more investment goes into keeping it safe, calling the police, making sure the streetlights are, all those things
That's right.
When you're homeowners. But it's a radical idea. Was it a hard sell to these congregations that you could possibly forget about whether it's a Christian responsibility? Will it work? I mean, all those things had to be difficult.
That's right. It wasn't a hard sell at all. It describes the difference between organizing in Queens and organizing in East Brooklyn. In Queens, the organizing effort was mainly one of conserving what they had and keeping others out. In Brooklyn, it was 100% about change. And everybody in those congregations knew what that was and what they needed. And so this was a soft sell to the congregations in East Brooklyn. They said, "Let's do this." Very little convincing needed.
How about convincing your family that you're going to live in the parsonage in those neighborhoods?
Well, in that, being a very principled pastor, I had decided long before that the pastor, if he or she wanted to pastor a congregation, you had to live where the people were, period. That it was unacceptable to think about living elsewhere. This became more difficult a little bit later when we went to the South Bronx, the most devastated part of New York City. In the interview with the leaders of the congregation in the South Bronx, St. John's, the board had just really one question of substance, and that is whether my family and I would live in the parsonage, which was attached to the church building. It had been vacant for 13 years. Previous clergy wouldn't live there. It's one of the only buildings on the block. And without even consulting my wife, who was back in Brooklyn when I went up for the interview, I said, "Of course we will." For 8 years, then, we lived in that parsonage, and it became increasingly more difficult, more dangerous for us. I could give you some dramatic stories about that. But finally, my wife put her foot down. She's been my buffer to the kids. But finally she said, either we move together or we'll move alone. But you got to make a decision. And well, so we rented an apartment in another part of the Bronx at that time for the next 4 years. And by this time, the congregation was relieved by that decision. They knew where my heart was. And they were ashamed that they could not protect their pastor.
Well, were any of you hurt?
Each of our kids was accosted in one way or another. Our oldest daughter, for example, was on the stoop of our house, the parsonage, when and coming home from a date with a young man, and on the steps leading into our house, at gunpoint, her boyfriend was had to take his clothes off, all the way down to his shorts, and robbed. And we were inside the house and didn't know this was happening. Now, neither of them was hurt, but it was utterly humiliating and dangerous. Our middle daughter, who lives here in Durham, was brought home from Stony Brook, New York University, New York State University, and classmate who brought her home was viciously attacked in the South Bronx after dropping our daughter off, asked for directions, one of those cases of not knowing how to get to the GW Bridge, was stabbed through the car window in the South Bronx. Our son, our youngest blonde, we decided to have him go to high school outside the community at Fordham Prep, and coming home on the city bus, he was once hit in the face stepping off the bus, just clobbered, comes home crying, a high school young man, and in that case, for being white. And these were mortifying experiences for my wife and me. We never were accosted. My wife got propositioned once in a while. The kids hadn't signed on for this. Neither had my wife in a way, but she was loyal, a loyal spouse. And we got through those years. It wasn't easy.
Did they shake your faith?
They certainly shook the faith of our kids. Mm-hmm. And I will say, I think that each one of the three, after having been able to come through that and become adult, realizes that this was not all negative training for life. And we're okay about it now. It was a little bit tough at that time.
They had a hard time with it.
Yeah.
And it affected your relationship with them?
Yeah. No, it did. It did. They wondered whose side I was on.
As you look back now, I mean, how do you feel about that? Those had to be some tough decisions.
Those were not altogether positive decisions. Theoretically, I now realize that in some very new and vital ways that my family has to come first. And this mistress of ministry. But I was messed up on that in those years and thought that my work had perhaps more compelling reasons for my activity than even my family. Bad decisions. We got to East Baltimore, which was the most like the South Bronx of any other place I'd been. My wife and I, kids were all gone now. Decided we would not live in the parish. So we'd made some evolution by that time. Yeah.
if you decide to live a life of conscience, there are lots of tough decisions, I suppose, that you can look back on. But the fact that you keep putting yourself in harm's way to make those difficult decisions, I think, is admirable. And we're going to continue our conversation with Reverend John Heinemeier when the State of Things continues in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking with Reverend John Heinemeier, more than 50 years in the ministry. Much of that time spent in very difficult neighborhoods, low-wealth neighborhoods. You talked about going to Baltimore and making the decision there to live somewhere else. But before you got to Baltimore and after the Bronx, you were in Boston. Tell us about that.
The fact is, what I learned in Brooklyn and in the Bronx was that if the church was going to be an agent of change in what was happening in the neighborhood, you had to do, one of the ways was through faith-based organizing. And so when I got to Boston in 94, when we got to Boston, I helped to create another organization. This was the third time now, called Greater Boston Interfaith Organization. And it's one of the principles of church culture that I'm pretty sold on, and that is that if you want to be an agent of change rather than just service, you got to have enough power to do that. And to have enough power to pull that off, you need to be working with other, not only ecumenically, but also with other faiths, Jewish, Muslim as well. The best instance of that that I'm acquainted with, that I was acquainted with, was the one in Boston, Greater Boston Interfaith. There we decided to try to organize not just Boston, but also the suburbs. It was an enormous task, very different from Brooklyn and in the Bronx, where we simply were organizing communities of color. Much more difficult. I'm happy to say that what they did in Boston, they became one of the forerunners, really, of Obamacare in terms of helping to pass the Massachusetts Health Care Act. Mm-hmm. And drawing a blank right now. Who was the governor?
Well, Mitt Romney.
He was there.
Had to live it
That's
down.
That's exactly right.
Obamacare
That's
preceded
right.
by his opponent.
And,
I think this again. You know, we're talking about basic needs, and again, this economy fails to meet the basic needs. The market economy will not meet the health needs of its people. Look at how many people are underserved, and it doesn't meet the housing needs. So again, it takes these faith communities to come together because market ain't doing it. But what is it like to organize those folks, especially in the suburbs, where they might – somebody along the way, Pastor, has told you this when you were organizing. I'm just going to guess that Jesus said the poor will always be among us. It's not our job, Pastor. Have you ever heard that?
I've heard it a few times,
yeah, I
yes.
bet.
it was difficult. This organizing is done, however, on the basis of enlightened self-interest. And what those suburban congregations had to bring to the table was their own issues. The city had its share of issues, but each congregation that was involved had to negotiate for its needs to be met. And that's what kind of leveled it. Each community had its needs, very different needs, but coming there with their own self-interests. It was, in some ways, more exciting organizing, in some ways not nearly with the zest of East Brooklyn or South Bronx. Those New York meetings and organizing was very heady and exciting. A little less so in the Bronx, in Boston. But Resurrection Church, where I was, the Lutheran Church there near Dudley Square in Roxbury, one of the concomitants of this working among and with the economically disadvantaged is that you try to stay away from charity. You try to be an agent where the community itself can can be uplifted, can lift itself up. And this has some real, for example, Roxbury now is being gentrified in Boston, rather radically so. Dudley Square, a block from where Resurrection was, now is becoming a node, a high-tech node in Boston. The school administrative office is moving to Roxbury now. That's finally a good thing.
Unless it pushes people out. Well, and one of the first things you noticed with Nehemiah, right, was here's a place nobody wanted to live. You have to move heaven and earth to get the package together to build the houses. Now, all of a sudden, it's so attractive, you have to worry about gentrification.
Isn't that something? Yeah. So there's some real downsides to that. But the upside is that why shouldn't folks who are once poor also have a shot at it? And that's the other side of it. Rather than if this community starts to rise, well, then I have to leave. I can't stand it to be working among people who are rising. No. It's being a part of that rising that the faith community has to be engaged in.
Yeah. Well, you did go to Baltimore after Boston, and essentially, as I understand it, you really had two congregations in one church, right? Can you describe that for us?
Well, yes. This was on East North Avenue, which is only a few blocks east of West North Avenue, where all of the commotion was months ago.
Yeah.
The congregation there at Faith Lutheran, vast majority lived outside the community. And I tried to be a good pastor to them, but my heart was in the community. And this was no clearer stated than when I was ready to leave East Baltimore. The congregation had a very, very fine farewell at a catering hall, really a nice event. And I was very happy with that. And then the next weekend, we had a cookout there at the church. And this was for the community. And as I've often said to people, I'd be hard-pressed to say which was my favorite congregation. The community, there were a number of them now who were members of the church, but there's where my heart was, my real heart. I was kind of a chaplain to the congregation, and I was pastor in that neighborhood.
Well, I'm guessing the reason you had this situation was because people who had gone to that church had moved out of the neighborhood.
That's correct, all of them.
And they may have been mostly white. African-Americans move into the neighborhood. They're now the community, the church surrounding community. So people left for a reason. What was it like to say, let's bring everybody together under one roof?
There was one small exception to what you just said. The congregation was 100% black.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
In other words, black folks had lived in that neighborhood and moved out.
All right.
The very thing that you would hope they would be enabled to do now became a problem. You would hope that every single one of them could move out of that community. And I often said this to the folks. I wish every one of you could, but that you would decide to stay here. And that was like talking in the wind for the most part. Some resentment. The local community was no longer their parish. There was tension, there was friction in that, no doubt.
You left Baltimore in 2008 to retire, I will put in quotes. That didn't last long. Moved to Durham and then took a position with an Episcopal church in Oxford, right?
That's correct. I needed something part-time. And the bishop of North Carolina Diocese, Michael Curry, who, by the way, is one of the candidates now for presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, will be decided in a couple weeks, the 27th of June. He needed a part-time priest at St. Cyprian's, a historically black congregation in Oxford. A congregation, when it was established in 1906, was not allowed to go to the larger white church that's there in Oxford. That has been a marriage made in heaven. That has, my wife and I both say, it's probably the best place we've ever been. We've been so well received there. It is going to be heartbreaking in 3 weeks now for us to leave there. Absolutely heartbreaking. But since being there, a very dramatic thing has happened, and that congregation has decided to integrate towards Latino. There's no Roman Catholic Church in Oxford, and here's this growing community of Latinos who don't have a mother church nearby. And so they decided to do that. I prompted that a little bit, I will admit. And they decided, furthermore, that they would worship together every Sunday, bilingually.
So there won't be the Spanish language mass and the English language mass. And that means, let me just point out here, what that means is that congregation has decided, the English-speaking congregation has said, we are willing to take the extra time. I guess that means the Spanish congregation, too, to have a bilingual mass, right? Both parties have to say, mass is going to take a little bit longer.
That's right. And it won't all be in my language.
And it won't all be in my language.
It's a concomitant of reaching out, what Stephanie Spellers calls in Radical Welcome, her book, she says, of reaching out to the other. It implies you are willing, the persons reaching out are willing to be acted upon as well as to act. So it's taken real generosity of spirit in the part of the black congregation to do this. They really need to be credited for this.
Well, and historically there had been, and I don't know how much of that is still true today, but certainly in a couple of decades ago, there had been tensions between African-American and Latino communities as Latino population moved in and began taking some of the lower wage jobs.
That's, I think, is still the case.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that it is more difficult, for example, for a black congregation to integrate towards Latino than it is for a white congregation. Mm-hmm. They have been made by our culture rivals for crumbs. And so they are not usual partners. And here is a little congregation in Oxford, North Carolina, that is by far the most integrated congregation in the county, and a model for the whole diocese of
North Carolina. Was it difficult work? Did the congregation come to you? Did you have to – was it hard work to
get this happen? Well, I'll tell you, we hit it lucky, Frank. The very first person that I met, Latina, in the Oxford area, is a Mary Kay salesperson. She knows everybody.
And she can sell.
That's right. So first of all, she brought her wider, her extended family, yeah. And evangelism, missionary work in the church has happened in this instance the way it's supposed to. And that is, it's a matter of people telling their friends and their network to come on over and visit. It's been an absolute joy the way that has developed at St. Cyprian's. The congregation is now about 50-50, black and Latino.
I will tell you, Pastor, you have just engaged on some of the most dangerous work of your career, because when you bring poor people together who have been set apart through economic forces that are not always unconscious of what they're doing, and you bring them together, that's the most dangerous work in America.
Yeah. But last Sunday, yesterday, we had black folks clapping when I told them about the Finance Committee meeting in Raleigh last Tuesday, where they voted on the restricted driver's permit bill. Finance Committee, not House, not Senate, certainly not Governor.
Yeah.
But where the Finance Committee passed that, after vigorous debate, most of it negative, they got up to vote and they said, we want this. No, it's still not done.
No, but that would be a basically a driver's license for without documentation.
A specialized driver's license. Which it would allow people after seven, 8 years of no licenses to go to work, to drive to work.
A victory for the Latino population.
Big time. But here you had black folks clapping as well as Latinos.
All right, so you're going to retire again, they say, 3 weeks.
28th.
Really?
28th. I told the bishop I'd be willing to do some selected assignments, but I'm going on 80 right now, and I'm not ready to continue on pastoring a congregation. I've decided to slow up a little bit.
So as you look back over your story, and by the way, I don't believe you. I don't think you're lying, because, of course, you're a man of the cloth. You wouldn't deliberately lie, but I bet you're going to be busy. You know, how do you see it? How do you sort of evaluate your own legacy?
I think I would use the word grace as the primary notion. For a country boy from Texas, who grew up in segregated Texas, barefoot, to have been this well received and this effective in ministry, really, in the Northeast, has been just a matter of grace. And I think about that often. I think about it probably on a weekly basis, how unpredictable this has been and how gracious. And I'm just, I'm very, very thankful here at the close of this full-time ministry or ministry with a congregation that it's been possible. Very thankful.
We are thankful for your grace-filled presence this afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Amen.
Reverend John Heinemeier is a vicar of St. Cyprian's Episcopal Church in Oxford, North Carolina. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. By the way, tomorrow we're going to be in Greensboro. You can be in our live audience. Find out about details at RSV. You can send us an RSVP at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our intern is Andrew Tai. WNC's news director is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.